Thomas. So if you can find page 680, Song of Songs, chapter 1, beginning at verse 1, reading down to 2, verse 7. Solomon's Song of Songs. She sings, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the young women love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. Friends, we rejoice and delight in you. We will praise your love more than wine. She, how right they are to adore you. Dark am I, yet lovely, daughters of Jerusalem, dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I'm darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards. My own vineyard I had to neglect. Tell me, you whom I love, where you graze your flock and where you rest your sleep at midday. Why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? Friends, if you do not know, most beautiful of women, follow the tracks of the sheep and graze your young goats by the tents of the shepherds." He sings, "I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot horses. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels. We will make your earrings of gold studded with silver." She, "While the king was at his table, my perfume spread its fragrance. My beloved is to me a sachet of myrrh resting between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms from the vineyards of En-Gedi." He, "How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves." She, "How handsome you are, my beloved. Oh, how charming, and our bed is verdant." He, "The beams of our house are cedars, our rafters are firs." She, "I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys." He, "Like a lily among thorns is my darling among the young women." She, "Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my beloved among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. Let him lead me to the banquet hall, and let his banner over me be love. Strengthen me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am faint with love. His left arm is under my head, and his right arm embraces me. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or waken love until it so desires."
Well, please do keep that open in front of you as we look at it. Thanks very much for reading it for us, Claire. We're looking at Song of Songs, chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 7. A philosopher called Jay Budziszewski wrote these words: "Looking out over the sexual landscape of our time, I see a terrain of unutterable sweetness despoiled by unmentionable pain." I wonder if you can relate to that mixture of sweetness and pain. Perhaps some are especially aware of the sweetness just now. Perhaps we've fallen in love or feel a deepening intimacy in a relationship. Perhaps we're grateful for a long and contented and secure marriage. But many of us will also know something about the pain, the unfulfilled longings, shattered hopes, broken relationships, perhaps, deep hurts over being rejected, perhaps even being abused, deep guilt because of failings in the past, maybe years ago, or maybe just very recently, right now. And sometimes pain and shame in this area goes deeper. We feel we couldn't really talk about it with, with most people. And so we bear it alone. So the whole area is a sensitive one and a difficult one for us. It needs handling very carefully, but we can trust the word of God to do that. As we sang earlier, your word is good. It's a light to my path. It brings truth. If this is an area that is close to us and important to us and that we feel strongly about, then all the more reason to come to God to hear what he has to say about it. And that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be, over the next 6 Sundays, we're going to be looking at this book in the Bible, the Song of Songs, a book entirely about romantic love. We'll be looking in the Bible studies, if you're part of Roots, Young Adults Group, we'll be looking at some related passages, some of the other passages that tie in, that give us the context for this book. We'll be having a guest service on that theme, Is God Anti-Sex? These are things that we need God's help with. And we're going to start by looking at the title of Song of Songs, The Best Song, chapter 1, verse 1, very short, simple title there. The song starts claiming, I think, to be the greatest song. As it says there, Solomon's Song of Songs. Notice first that it's Solomon's. Now, Solomon was king of the Old Testament kingdom of God at its peak, at its best and finest time, at its golden age. When he became king, he longed to rule God's kingdom with God's wisdom. And so he started by asking God to give him wisdom. And it was the right thing to do. He was given wisdom. We're told in 1 Kings chapter 4 that he wrote thousands of proverbs and lots of songs. And yet in the end, Solomon couldn't live by his own wisdom. In fact, his greatest failures of all was in this area of sexual love. He had hundreds of women in his life, many of them at the same time. They didn't share his faith, some of them. And that is what led him away from God in the end. And that was the cause of huge problems in the kingdom of God, that the peak turned into a downward spiral from that moment on. Because I think the Bible is telling us that we actually need a better kingdom than that. We need a better king. As great as King Solomon was, he was still sinful. All people are. And that's why we need Jesus. Jesus, who is without sin, who is our king, who came saying, one greater than Solomon is now here. Now, verse 1 doesn't really tell us for sure whether Solomon actually wrote this song himself. Perhaps he did. Perhaps it was part of his collection, Solomon's greatest song, the greatest song in his collection of wisdom. Whether he wrote it or not, it does seem to me that this is not about Solomon's own romantic relationship. It's not about his own love life. Lots of reasons for thinking that. For example, verses 6 and 7 describe a couple doing, this couple are doing ordinary, humble work. They're working outdoors in vineyards and with shepherds and looking after sheep. That's not something King Solomon ever did himself. lots of other reasons as well. It's true that she does sometimes sing about her lover as being a king. In verse 4, for example. But you hear that in most ancient love songs. And after all, she wouldn't be the only bride-to-be who daydreams about her wedding day and imagines it as being like a royal wedding. And thinks of it in those terms. To her, it is a royal wedding. It's her wedding. And so she sings about it in that way. So it's Solomon's Song of Songs. Secondly, notice that it is a song. From verse 1, it's a song. Don't miss that. That's important when you're reading the Bible to realize you're reading a song. Don't expect it to be a kind of to tell a logical story in the order that things happen or to make a kind of detailed argument like you might read in one of the epistles. Don't expect rules on what to do and what not to do. That's not how songs work. You can't pin down every word and clarify every sentence and always be sure about what every detail is meant. Probably some of your favourite songs still confuse you and puzzle you. You're not always sure what every part of every line is really getting at. But that isn't the point of a song. The point of a song is to evoke something, to make you feel something, to help you relate to it, to be drawn into the atmosphere and the mood and engage with those feelings. And the song certainly does that. It's a song. And then thirdly, from verse 1, notice it's the song of songs. The holiest of holies in the Bible, that means the most holy place of all in the temple. The King of Kings in the Bible means the greatest king over all other kings. And the Song of Songs means the greatest song over all other songs. This is the best song, certainly in the wisdom collection of Solomon, and perhaps the best song of all. Now, what would a song like that be about? What would you think the Bible would lift up as the thing that it would most want to sing about, most want to celebrate, most want to praise as the greatest song in the wisdom that Christians have? Well, it starts with sexual desire. That's what the song starts with, chapter 1, verses 2 to 4. It begins with attraction, the first steps in love. Here is this girl, and she's talking with her friends, and she's talking with her friends about this guy that she's seen and how she feels about him. Chapter 1, verse 2. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the young women love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. And then the friends say, we rejoice and delight in you. That's male in him. We will praise your love more than wine. And she sings how right they are to adore you. Do you see that? She is longing for him to kiss her. I don't think this is a kind of polite peck on the cheek that you get from your granny at Christmas. She's talking about kisses in the plural. She emphasizes his mouth. I long for the kisses of your mouth, she says. The word that she uses for love in verse 2 is a word for physical love. Very literally, it means caresses. And she says in verse 4, she wants him to take her away, to sweep her off her feet. Where does she want him to take her? To his chambers, to his rooms, to his private apartment, away from everyone else, to be alone with him. It's a song of desire, and it's very sensual. There is taste in verse 2. His love is better than wine. It's delicious, delightful, intoxicating. There is smell, verse 3. She perhaps catches the aftershave as he walks past, and he just smells so good to her. There's the sound of his name, verse 3. You might want to imagine her practicing her signature and thinking, well, I wonder what my signature would be like if I put his surname on the end. Let's try that. Oh, yeah, that sort of looks right, flows nicely. And her friend's kind of peeping over her shoulder. And she loves his name so much, she's just always talking about him with her friends. She is convinced, you know, she is so attracted to him, she thinks that everybody must surely see it. Surely everyone is after him, and they feel like, well, they have to agree with her. She won't shut up unless they say, yes, you're right, he's really amazing. And she says, no wonder all the young women love you. How right they are to adore you. In her eyes, he is so eligible and desirable. It's a song about sexual desire. And it's also a song about insecure desire. That's the next part of the song, verses 5 to 14. Insecure desire. Does she dare to pursue him? Does she have the nerve to do that? We know how she feels about him, but she's not so sure how is he going to feel about her. Chapter 1, verse 5. Dark am I, yet lovely. Daughters of Jerusalem, dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I am darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards, my own vineyard I had to neglect. Dark am I, yet lovely, she says. She's perhaps slightly defensive there. Yes, I know I'm dark, but lovely. She's talking to the daughters of Jerusalem, so they're city girls. Which I guess means in those days they don't spend much time outside in the hot sun. And so their skin is pale. I'm told in ancient times, girls didn't really go for a fake tan. They didn't rush to the beach to get their skin darker. That wasn't the fashion. They'd be much more likely to have parasols or little umbrellas to shade themselves, to keep their skin as pale as possible to show that they were actually from the kind of class that could afford to be inside and not out on the farms getting suntanned. Pale skin, you see, it's fashionable, it's sophisticated, but the girl who is singing this song, well, she hasn't been able to manage that kind of pale skin. She hasn't been able to look after her looks in the way her friends have, because she's had to work outside. There's no mention of a father. Perhaps he died, perhaps he left, we don't know. She talks about her brothers as being her mother's sons. It's a funny way to talk about them. They're angry with her. Are they stepbrothers, perhaps? They don't get on with her. And they force her to work so hard outside in the family business, in the vineyard, that she can't look after her own affairs, her own vineyard, as she calls it. She can't look after her own prospects. It's a sort of Cinderella story, I guess. This hard-working girl being forced into this by an unloving family. She's got rags, she's got no ball gown to go and meet her prince. So how is she going to meet him? She's not really feeling very confident about it, but it would be great if she could just bump into him. You know, maybe she could kind of arrange that engineer. It just happened to be there. If only she knew where he takes his lunch break when he's working out on the fields with the shepherds. That's what she's saying in verse 7. Tell me, you whom I love, where you graze your flock and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? I don't want to go hunting for you and asking your friends where you are. They'll think I'm like one of those veiled women, like a prostitute. They wear a veil so that they won't be identifiable, and they go chasing money for men for money. She doesn't want to look like she's kind of desperate and go round all these blokes in the lunch hour trying to find the one that she's after. That's humiliating for her. So how am I ever going to find him? And her friends, calm, sensible, give her a suggestion. Verse 8, if you do not know, most beautiful of women, follow the tracks of the sheep and graze your young goats by the tents of the shepherds. You are beautiful, they say, don't worry. And look, just take some goats with you, everyone will think you're looking after them. And just follow the tracks of his sheep and you might find him. And so we imagine her nervous and hesitant and unsure. Of course she is. She knows how she feels, but how is he going to feel? And off she goes to find him. And now for the first time, he speaks. Is this going to be one of those awful, embarrassing teenage crushes that you try to forget ever happened, where he's just not interested? Or will he feel the same way? For the first time, he speaks. In verse 9, I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot horses. Well, it doesn't seem like a great start, does it? I mean, he compares her to a horse. Guys, if you are wondering what to write in your Valentine's cards next month, and there's and the girl that you've got in mind, I don't recommend that you start this way. I liken you, my darling, to a mare. I don't think that's going to improve your chances very much. But of course, this is ancient poetry, not modern poetry. And they spent a lot of time with animals, and they perhaps felt about them a bit differently. I think what's going on here is that Pharaoh's chariots, the army chariots, they were all being pulled by male horses. And apparently, if you were really cunning and you wanted to defeat the enemy army, what you did is you sent along a female horse, and all the male horses would go crazy and the chariots would go all over the place and you could win the battle. And he is saying to her, look, I know you were worried what my male friends were going to think of you. And the answer is everyone's going to be crazy when they see you. They're all going to be making you jewelry and gifts and trying to get a chance with you. As it goes on. Verse 10, your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your necks with strings of jewels. We, you know, me and my friends will make you earrings of gold studded with silver. So that insecure desire begins to turn into mutual desire. You can imagine the song becoming more like a duet now. The male and the female voice going backwards and forwards. They're each singing things to each other, and what they're saying is pretty much the same. They feel the same way about each other. Verse 15, how beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful your eyes are, doves. Verse 16, how handsome you are, my beloved. Oh, how charming. and our bed is verdant. Actually, verses 15 and 16, they're much more similar than they look in the English. They're almost the same words, just the male version, the female version. Your eyes are like doves. He says, I have no idea what he means by that. Who knows? But what it does tell us is that that's where he's looking. He's gazing into her eyes. It's very intimate, isn't it? And they lay back, I guess they lay back on the grass. He's on his lunch break at work. And she says, look, our bed is green. It's verdant. The word's just green. Look, we're lying on a green bed. And he says, yes, look, and the tree branches are like the roof of our house. And she says, meeting me must be like seeing one flower in a valley covered in flowers. There must be so many girls to choose from. And he says, no, if you're a flower, you're a flower among thorns. No one else can compare to you. Chapter 2, verse 1. I'm a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. He says, verse 2, like a lily among thorns is my darling among the young women. And she replies in very much the same way about him. If she's a flower among thorns, he is a good tree among lots of other trees. You can picture her perhaps walking through a dark, difficult forest and through all these tangled trees. And then there's a lovely apple tree. Perfect place to rest in the shade and take a break from your walk and eat some nice fruit. Chapter 2, verse 3, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my beloved among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. Well, this is a song I think we've all heard. I don't know what your taste in music is. I don't know what generation you belong to, what era or style of music you listen to, but I can pretty much guarantee you've heard a song with lyrics along these lines, modern version of these lyrics, those first tentative steps in love. The attraction, the insecurity and self-doubt, the will they, won't they, and then the feeling is mutual. If you happen to be a teenage girl in 2011, or if you happen to know any teenage girls in 2011, you probably will have heard of this guy, Harry Styles, and his band One Direction. You probably will know that song lyric, You Don't Know You're Beautiful. It seems that most teenage girls were longing for someone that they saw as being popular and eligible and young and good-looking, and someone like Harry Styles to look at them and say, look, better yet, to sing, you don't know, but you're actually really beautiful. Have a look at the lyrics. Get your neighbour to hum you the tune if you don't recognise the song. I would sing it for you, but I think that would spoil the whole sermon, so I'm not going to try that. But have a look. It's like a sort of modern version of Song of Songs chapter 1. And I guess we're not surprised to hear songs like that. But maybe we're surprised to find one in the Bible. Does it surprise you that the greatest song of all songs in the collection of wisdom for Christians is about sexual desire? Were you expecting that? Some religions and philosophies in the world are really very negative about anything to do with the body, and certainly anything to do with sex. Their idea is that things to do with the spirit and the heavens are good, and this world is just kind of dirty and not right, not so good, and we should escape the body and avoid sex and avoid pleasure and just kind of suffer and be on a higher plane. And that view is not at all biblical, but it has had quite a lot of influence on the Christian church at different times in different places in history. Too much influence. So, for example, in the Middle Ages, a guy called Bernard of Clairvaux managed to preach 86 sermons, all of them published, on the Song of Songs to a group of celibate monks without ever mentioning sex or romance. He just assumed that all the imagery in it was actually nothing to do with relationships or men and women, and it was all sort of spiritual metaphors for something else. He spiritualized it. But love, attraction, desire are celebrated and sung about in the Bible as good gifts from a loving creator. The Bible begins with that. Did you notice that in our first reading? A love song. Adam sees Eve for the first time. We're told they're both naked, and we're told they're not ashamed. And well, the words look very much like a song. He sings to her something you could probably roughly paraphrase as, wow. And then we're told that the two become one flesh, one body. At the start of our service, Andy read some words written by Paul. And he has found already that in the church, this idea is creeping in that sex and food are bad, and that if you're a really proper Christian, you wouldn't get married, and, you know, you would avoid certain foods. And he says, no. He says, everything that God made for us is a good gift. And so long as we're receiving it as a good gift and thanking God for it and enjoying it in the light of his word, then it's holy and it's pure and it's good and it's healthy. And we should be thankful. That urge to merge is built into who we are. It's right. It's good. There's nothing dirty about it. There's nothing shameful. Now, of course, we live in a sinful, disobedient world. And of course, we abuse that gift. And we all sin in this area like in every other area. And it's very easy then to just think the whole thing is dirty and shameful. And that's not, well, there is teaching in the Bible. There are warnings in the Bible. We'll come to those. But that's not where the Bible starts. It starts by saying what a good and wonderful thing it is to be attracted to someone and to fall in love with them. Now, how does it make you feel? I mean, be honest for a moment. You walk along, it's a lovely day, you walk past a couple, they're very much in love, they're in each other's arms. How do you feel? You think, oh, that's really nice, that's really lovely. But I guess for some there's also a pang of sadness, remembering something you once had and have lost, or a pang of longing, you wish you had that. And what if that longing just continues our whole lives? What if we never find that kind of love, or we think we found it and then it goes wrong, or it cools off, or it's just... Well, the way to answer that is to say, well, why is this the Song of Songs? Why is sexual love the song? Why is that urge to merge in us so strong and so intense? And I think the answer is, if you look at the whole Bible, is that we're created that way for a reason, to point to something else. Not just the love between a man and a woman, but to point to the relationship that we are created for, the relationship with Jesus Christ. He talks about himself as the groom, the bridegroom, and his people as the bride. That idea of one flesh, we're told later in the Bible, is really about being one with Jesus. Not on our own, not in isolation and privacy, just in our own room having this sort of supernatural relationship. Not that. All of us as his church are his bride. So the intimacy that we long for and the loneliness that we struggle with are never going to be fully satisfied with a relationship, a romantic relationship. It's pointing us to what we really need, what we're really made for. The intimacy we're to find with one another, with God's eternal family, that we're one with forever. And that we're to find above all with Jesus, united with Jesus, one with Jesus, loved by him in a deeper way than anyone else will ever love us. Well, just a couple more verses to look at before we finish. The best song is about sexual desire. It's about insecure desire. It's about mutual desire. But notice also it's about desire that waits. That waits, chapter 2, verses 4 to 7. Let him lead me to the banquet hall, and let his banner over me be love. Strengthen me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am faint with love. His left arm is under my head, and his right arm embraces me. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Now, verse 7 must be important, because it's repeated three times in the song, always in a particularly key place in the way it's written. She is saying, be careful, wait. There is a wedding in this song. It's the right at the centre of the song. The whole song revolves around this royal wedding. But she's not there yet, and she's not finding it easy to wait. You can see that from verses 4 to 6, how difficult it is to wait. Verse 4, well, it's usually translated, "His banner over me is love." Another way to translate it more literally would be, "Let him look at me for lovemaking." It's not really got much to do with flags, I suspect. That's her longing. That unfulfilled desire is making her weak. Verse 5, she says, "Strengthen me, refresh me. I'm ready to faint because of this love." The intensity and the power of that desire, she says, is so strong once you start to feel its pull that just be very careful. Verse 7, "Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires." She's not speaking here as a sort of stern, older person. This is not someone who might perhaps be a little bit repressed or negative about love, wanting to spoil all the fun for young people. No, this is a young woman herself. She's just fallen head over heels in love, and she's speaking to her female friends, daughters of Jerusalem, it says, verse 7. She's speaking to them, and she's saying, be careful. Don't wake up these sorts of feelings until the time is right. Because once you've got them started, once they're aroused and awakened, sexual desire, it won't easily dampen down again. It will demand consummation. It's very hard not to go there. And when the time is right, and when the person is right, and when all the things are in place that the Bible talks about, it's a wonderful good gift from God. But with the wrong person, at the wrong time, in the wrong context, there's so much heartache. And so much pain. And if we're honest, we have, most of us probably, perhaps all of us, fallen short in this area. And not waited as we should have done. And this is where the song is encouraging us to focus on our desire for Christ. Will we desire him? Will we desire him in the way, not exactly the same way, but in something like the way she desires this guy? Will we see that he actually stands out from the crowd? Or all the other relationships that we might have, all the people that might attract our attention, you know, that desire is natural and God-given, but it's pointing us to the one that we should really desire above all, far greater and far better than any human love. Have you spotted that? Have you felt yourself drawn to him, to Jesus Christ? You may well be feeling insecure about that. Will he feel the same way? I mean, we let him down, we fail him, we're spoiled, we're sinful, we're messed up, we feel guilty. How would he feel about us? He'll see us as we are. But we meet Jesus and we discover that he has nothing but love for us. That his love for us is greater than any other we've experienced. That he would even die for us, messed up as we are, to be one with us forever. We're so dark, sinful, broken, rebellious. But he loves us. So let's give thanks. Let's give thanks and praise God for love and for desire and for sex. Praise God for that good gift. But let's desire something much greater than that gift. And let's long for Jesus Christ.